It's time to take this game into overtime. The official podcast of the Average Joe's Sports Show on 90.9 The Light Sports for our generation.
We will begin with the Furious Five as we always do, and we'll start with the World Series Game 3 last night. If you missed it, you missed a good one as the World Series returned to Wrigley Field in Chicago for the first time since 1945. You had to pay to be there. But a lot of people did. The Cleveland Indians came out victorious, 1-0 the score, behind some shutdown pitching. And that's always what you want to see in the World Series. Tomlin comes in for Cleveland, 4 2/3 of an inning, allows just 2 hits. Miller gets the win in 1.1. Allen gets the save. Guys, we talk about all the momentum was kind of swinging Chicago's way after the big win in Game 2. Then you head home in front of your fans, and it's really been the pitching for Cleveland. Is that going to cripple Chicago to the point where they're going to be unable to come back? And now they're starting Corey Kluber tonight on short rest. So they're really going to try to pull ahead and take the 3-1 game advantage. What is your take on Cleveland's pitching? Is it going to be able to dominate Chicago to the point where they can't return?
No. And I say that just based on what they did after they had a chance to look at Kershaw in the NLCS and then what they were able to do to him. I think if they get a chance to see these pitchers, especially like with Kluber on short rest, given the chance of a hot bat of any of the Cubs getting a streak going, we saw what they did. I mean, they put up 10 points, 8 points. I don't think that the Indians are going to be able to control the way they think they are based on past performances. I think the Cubs are going to have enough wherewithal to be able to adjust to that pitching style and really be able to hit.
Yeah, I think as far as pitching goes for the Indians, the reliefs are where it's at. Allen and Miller have 25 scoreless innings in the postseason, 45 strikeouts. But like you said, if the Cubbies decide to get a hot bat, it's going to be hard to stop. No matter who's pitching.
It doesn't matter. We saw them do that with Kershaw. I mean, as soon as they hadn't seen him in the regular season, and Kershaw pitched that first game and held him scoreless, and that was still a close game at 1-0. But as soon as they saw what he was doing, they were able to watch tape, adjust to it, figure out how fast and where those pitches were going, and then we saw what they did to him. I mean, they just kept hitting. They started that game hitting the second time they saw him. So I don't know if I would expect them to really fall behind in this.
So the pitching for at least Chicago, you got to really kind of hang your head a little bit if you're the Cubs. You use Jake Arrieta in Game 2. Obviously, that's kind of a given because you want to kind of save him if you're going to be able to get back in and you pitch him in Game 6 again. And then Kyle Hendricks. And now you have John Lackey. But you have Lester, Arrieta, Hendricks, and Lackey. That's probably one of the most bolstered, if not the most bolstered, MLB pitching staff in the MLB. Excuse me. So you have all those guys. Now you have to match up against, you know, they have to hold their bullpen down for the Cleveland Indians. Do you think it's more of a issue where Cleveland's pitching is getting to Chicago, or do you think the bats just need to get hot for the Cubs?
I think the bats.
That's for sure.
Yeah, definitely the bats need to move. And we saw the struggle with Schwarber wanting to hit and even getting a chance to pinch hit, broke his bat. He had a great swing on that last night. I believe that was the 8th inning. But I don't know if the Cubs need to really hang their heads, considering what Arrieta was able to do last night or the previous night in Game 2. And Kyle Hendricks pitched really well. I mean, we look at this game and we're wondering, you know, oh man, what went wrong with the Cubbies? I mean, they went, what, 7 innings?
Yeah.
0-0. Kyle Hendricks pitched his, you know, guts out again, as he's always done. Very silent, very quiet, humble about what he does, but he gets the job done. And it wasn't until the Cubs started moving people around that really gave the Indians a chance to get on the board. So you put the bats in play, and the Cubs got a chance.
Well, something that really stood out to me about this game was you had the Cubs out in the bottom of the 9th, and a 1-0 game right there. I mean, that's a save situation. That's a close one, and that's really a nail biter. You have all the fans on the side of the team that's down, and Cleveland was really able to keep their composure. You had a man on first, and then you had Zobrist struck out swinging, Contreras with the ground out, and then ultimately, so it
but
brings.
You did have the error by Mike Napoli that could have
changed
the game.
That was huge,
and that was where I honestly wasn't sure what was about to happen, because you had a really good opportunity to just finish out the game, and as soon as he had that error, it was an easy play that kind of bounced wrong, so I understand why he wasn't able to get it, but you got to stay down on those balls.
Having Mike Napoli out there at first plate, at first base is a very questionable decision with a guy who's really starting to show his age there. But anyway, so you had Baez come up for the Cubs, and that third strike that was thrown to seal the deal was a fastball upstairs, and I think that the pitcher on the mound for Cleveland, I think that he knew that Baez was just going to swing at it all, and you know, you had a 2-2 count, two outs, bottom of the ninth, runners on the corners. You could try for, you know, the off-speed pitch, but you don't want your catcher to lose sight of it, so he goes fastball, it's high. Baez just threw the house at it, and that was it. So I think calm, cool decision-making by Cleveland really sealed it up for Chicago. What adjustments do they have to make going into the next game?
For Cleveland, they need offense. They're not strong enough right now. Just putting up 1 point against the Cubs pitchers and the Cubs defense, they need to be able to get those bats hot. And I think their pitching staff is doing a really good job of course, rotating those pitchers through and through, as we've seen them do in the past and they're doing now, making sure that everybody doesn't get too stressed out or, you know, too fatigued in their arm. I am a little bit worried about what they're doing with Kluber on short rest, because, I mean, I'm guessing the reason they're putting him in is this is what they assume is going to be the last time that he pitches this season, so they're going to let him throw. Which is, you know, good, but also
look at the kind of decisions these guys have been making all throughout the playoffs. I mean, you had Kershaw come in. That was unbelievable. So it's really anyone's game in terms of, you know, making decisions and getting them out there. What do you think the Cubs have to make in terms of adjustments, Chris?
Cubs just have to get bats on the ball. I mean, last night with only five hits was kind of pitiful when you're talking about a World Series championship. Like, these are supposed to be two of the best teams in the league. Even though pitching was great, it wasn't phenomenal. So I expect a lot more than five hits out of the Cubs.
Well, we see it too also in just the hits at bat. They had a lot of fouled balls. A lot of pitches were pitched. That was one of the things that I noticed in this game, that when the pitches get up and that pitch count gets up, it's hard to keep those starters and people like Kyle Hendricks in the game. So both teams were doing a good job of just fighting to stay at bat and keep the ball alive and keep the game alive and the inning alive. So what they need to do is really get those bats smooth so that they're not, you know, ruining those opportunities for the pitchers. And if the Cubs do that, if they just stay alive in the box, they'll wear Andrew Miller down quickly, you know, given the opportunity. They'll wear that arm strength down. They'll wear those arm pitches down. And if they do that, they get two games before they will have to see, you know, that pitcher again. So that's what they really need to do, is just keep those, you know, at-bats alive.
All right, so your prediction now after watching Cleveland and watching Chicago try to make the push, try to, you know, stay in there with the probability gone of them winning the World Series at home, do you think they can do it on the road, or is it Cleveland's ballgame?
I think Cleveland's got upper hand right now.
Well, yeah.
Obviously.
I mean, going back, starting the home stretch?
I'll give Cleveland the upper hand, yes. But I still believe in the Cubs, just based on what we saw them do the previous two rounds, and especially in the NLCS, how as soon as they got going, and it's not like we're looking at them saying, oh, wow, they were really, you know, struggling. No, they were behind. They came back very handily. And so in a situation like this, I wouldn't be surprised if the Cubs come back handily.
All right, so your prediction?
Cubs.
In?
I think I put 7 at the beginning of the playoffs, so I'm going to stick 7.
I'm going to go Indians.
How many games?
I don't know. It's going to be a hard one to call. Let's get one more game in, and then I'll let you know.
So six.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm gonna go Indians in five.
See, they're gonna win the next two games at Wrigley.
Indians in six. I just after watching them, because I have been tuning into the World Series and the playoffs, and I think that they've kind of got it. They've kind of got their plan, and you have an experienced manager in the playoffs in Terry Francona. Bringing him in and bringing a guy like that who's already been there and who's been in the face of adversity, to say the least. I mean, he's putting together his team, he's putting together his game plan, and he's executing it, and that's why they are where they are. You can credit a lot of that to him. Yeah. So we move on now to professional basketball. It is in the house, folks. It has started, and Russell Westbrook has been off to a bang. You could say hoop. 51 points, 13 rebounds, and 10 assists. That was last night.
Last night.
He's so angry.
First 50-point triple-double since Kareem Abdul-Jabbar in 1975. I didn't realize he played that long ago.
Yes. Jeez. That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
The years really passed by. So, guys, it does not look like Russell Westbrook is missing Kevin Durant too much. People had been speculating about this, is that you have two of them together. There's a lot of conflict. Now it's Westbrook's team. Do you like this new look for the Thunder? Do you think it's going to do better for them? Or do you think they're going to miss KD?
I don't think they're going to miss KD at all. We were talking before the show, and I feel like KD and Westbrook, they didn't play the best together. I feel like their play style was kind of different, and to me, it seemed like they just always tried to dish the ball to KD, and Westbrook would take or not take some opportunities that he had just trying to make KD the playmaker. So I'm kind of excited to see what Westbrook's going to do without having Durant there.
Well, and we look at some of the situation. I mean, Durant had injuries and Westbrook had injuries, so they didn't always get to play together, and they never had that like cohesive bond that you really expected in two stars. There was a definite animosity for the ball and not necessarily the cohesion that we want. But looking this season, Westbrook has been, and we saw him last season, kind of take control of the offense, and we saw him do that in many ways. Want the ball in those situations, not always excited to give it to Durant for those winning shots, because Durant, he could make those shots, and he made those shots multiple times last season. And now Westbrook's a guy, and he's angry, and he's always been angry. But I believe Kobe Bryant last year said that Westbrook was the most athletic player he's ever played against. And that's saying a ton, considering Kobe did play against Michael Jordan.
Yeah.
And he's played against LeBron James and some of these other great basketball players of our time. Yet Westbrook is the guy that he said was the most athletic player. So, I mean, that's a big deal. But, I mean, we look at some of this roster, too. Westbrook's not alone. He's got Enes Kanter that's able to, you know, really help out in some of those situations. Steven Adams, you know, just a massive man.
Kind of where I was going to go next is you talk about Westbrook. Who's going to kind of step into that role to kind of help him out? Is it going to be Kanter? Is it going to be Adams? Is it going to be, Andre Robertson?
I would say Victor Oladipo.
Oladipo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, we've seen him really kind of be able to smooth things over the last just two games. And the situations that they have, he's playing around 40 minutes. I mean, this last game he played 40 minutes with 5 rebounds, 21 points. So, I mean, he's moving forward. It's a good shooting guard, and I definitely am looking forward to see what he does with Westbrook.
Where do you see, and this is kind of early, we've seen what Westbrook can do. I mean, we've seen it throughout the years, but now you look at him, and can he keep this up is the question. Can he lead the team? He's, you know, 27 years old. He's kind of going into the prime. Yeah, I know. Kyle, what have you done with your life?
Thank you so much.
Nah, I love you, buddy. So, listen, they all make us look like a bunch of bums. You know that.
Oh, my gosh.
So, do you think he can keep this up? Do you think he can lead the team? Do you see them being a top 4 seed in the West?
By the way, I trained with Russell Westbrook.
Come on. In October, it is October 29th. Do you see the Thunder being a top 4 seed in the West?
No. Well, in the West, yes. but not a top four seed overall. I mean, in the West, they're going to make the playoffs, and they're going to do an excellent job, really, against who they're playing. But you have to also understand, in their situation, the only two teams that they really have to worry about is the Jazz and the Trailblazers, which both of those teams are really solid. But that's just in their conference, the Northwest of the West, that they have to focus on. And I think they're going to outplay them. But other than that, you still have the Spurs, Clippers, and the Golden State Warriors to deal with. And if the Lakers play anything like they did, that's going to be another team in the West. That's fine. You can do all that you want.
We're going to move on.
They played very well.
We'll give you a call in about January. We'll see where the Lakers are.
Hey, let's see if Luke Walton's 39-4 again.
We'll see. We'll see if we're having the same conversation about, you know, the Knicks or the 76ers that we are the Lakers, but we will see.
I'm just saying.
Yeah, they're going to need a lot of change for that to happen. But
it
we
has
move
changed.
On now.
Did you not see them?
We move oh, on now. We have a midseason retirement. You got to love them. This time, a man only at the age of 30, Arian Foster has hung it up as a member of the Miami Dolphins. He started his career in 2009. Undrafted. Unbelievable. From 2009 to 2015, he was on the Texans, moved to Miami this year. Four-time Pro Bowl, first-team All-Pro in 2010, second-team in 2011. Two-time NFL rushing touchdown leader. He led the league in yards in 2010. 6,527 rushing yards, 54 rushing touchdowns. And yeah, that'll do it for him. The man from the Rocky Top, University of Tennessee. Guys, you already discussed this. Kyle, you have a very set opinion on this. Why did he retire? Is he Hall of Fame caliber? No. I think we could say that now. But why did he retire? Do you think it was time?
Well, and we've seen backs do this before. I'm pretty sure in this situation, nagging injuries, he's not able to ever get healthy. I mean, it's been the last 5 years, I think, have really just stressed him out and struggled with injuries. And then you have somebody like Jay Ajayi, who runs 200 yards the last 2 weeks and just absolutely blow everybody out of the water as a really upcoming running back. In a situation like that, it's going to take away any chance for Foster to really have the downs to run. So I think he saw it coming. And we have to remember, at 30 years old, he's taken a beating, and with those injuries, we've seen other athletes do that. I believe, you know, not to put him on the same, you know, we had just this last year, Calvin Johnson, didn't he? He's 30.
Yeah.
And he retired, and he's had nagging injuries. Marshawn Lynch is only a few years older, and he retired. Not that he had extreme injuries, but I think he was just tired of, you know, the beating that he took, and he had done what he had wanted to do. So, I mean, we've seen these different, you know, situations happen, and it's sad to see him go because he was a good back when he played, but these injuries just kept him down, and he was never able to get healthy. And I also feel bad because he never had that offensive line to give him those opportunities. And we see people like Zeke Elliott who can just run all over everybody, but he has an offensive line that is just super
dominating.
Human. Yeah, so
yeah, I think for him, injuries kind of led the way, which is good. When you see a guy retire this young, and the average shelf life of a running back is circa 10 or 11 years. You look at other players, you know, you look at the Brett Favre's of the world, and that means nothing. But it's tough to be a running back, and we've seen that from a lot of players. But we also see when a lot of players get other things get in the way of them having a long, prosperous career. And when you have the injuries, that's okay. They're trying to protect themselves. They're trying to protect their long-term stability. You can't argue with that, you know? Unfortunately, I think we're going to see Arian Foster go into that category of what should have been. You're going to have this select category of players, running backs in particular. I can think of two of them. I'm going to name them that are not going to make the Hall of Fame because they retired too early, because for whatever reason they could not stick around. So you can add him to the Tiki Barbers and the Sean Alexanders of the world. His stats are similar. In fact, he was a four-time All-Pro? Four-time All-Pro. Tiki Barber was a three-time All-Pro. Sean Alexander was a four-time Pro Bowl, And each of them, Barber and Alexander, made it three times. Barber was a one-time first-team All-Pro. Alexander was a two-time first-team All-Pro. And there are still people making the case for Sean Alexander to go to the Hall of Fame. If he'd stuck around three or four more years, absolutely.
For sure.
He was gone. He was there. But, you know, it just didn't happen. He ended up departing too early, and it was such a sharp decline. Unfortunately, I think Arian Foster had a little bit more of a well-lived career, but the injuries just didn't help.
Yeah, the injury, I mean, if you go back just to his NFL career, in 2010, knee injury. 2011, he had a leg injury. In 2012, he had a chest injury. 2013, a back and a calf. 2014, he had three leg injuries and a groin injury. 2015, yeah, Achilles and a groin. And then just this, what, week two of 2016, he missed three quarters to a groin injury. I mean, when you're taking that kind of stuff and then you have knee injuries that go back to college.
Yeah.
When he had the, what is it, arthroscopic knee surgery.
Yeah.
And then you go straight into the NFL 2 years later. I mean, it's something to battle with, especially a running back and taking the hits that he takes without that offensive line.
Well, right now, I think you could say, especially with a franchise that's only been around since 2002, he's the best running back in Texans franchise history. He will continue to hold the title. He holds five franchise records. He'll continue to hold the title for the best Texans running back in franchise history for, I don't know, the next 10 years, the next, who knows who will come along. It's a good career, not good enough to the Hall of Fame, but we certainly enjoyed it. Moving on now to another departation this week, not in the form of a person, but in the form of a service, I guess you could say. Vine has announced that it's shutting down this week. Now, obviously, that doesn't have anything directly to do with athletics, but it does. What is its effect on the sports world? Because you talk about, you know, the evolution of media, new media, and how it's affected sports, you know? You talk about, you know, back in the 20s when the first World Series was called, and then you had stuff popping up on television, and then you had color. When John Lennon died, you had that Don Meredith commentary on Monday Night Football. That was huge in December. Mm. I mean, all these things affect sports, you know? And now you had YouTube come out. You could watch you know, clips of your favorite sports players on demand. I could pull up anything I want now. Then you had Vine, those quick, you know, 5, 6, 7 second videos, and it affected sports a whole lot. Now, I don't know who wrote this on our rundown sheet, but I'm going to read it because I don't know why it's here. Most people say, "What?" I'm sorry, we're all journalism majors, right?
No.
No?
No.
What? Well, we need to learn about citing sources. What? Most people say Vine is better than America's Funniest Home Videos or SportsCenter's Not Top 10. So
I'm going to change that to just I say. And
okay,
then it'll
that's
work.
Fine.
I say.
That works. So, yeah, that's the thing with Vine is you could go.
Chris.
Why do you personally like that, Chris?
It's something that, like, it's if you're on Twitter and you're like, oh, guys, did you see this play? And, like, you don't have to
Most
go on YouTube.
Most of the Twitter videos that are posted are Vine. From Vine.
You're moving,
yeah. Because they were coincided together. Like, Twitter owned Vine.
And it's really difficult, too, because I remember 2 years ago when it really hit, I could scroll through Vines for probably a good 40 minutes with friends, and I would watch different sports plays after sports plays, whether they were awesome and they were like, I have to watch that again. Or if they were just hilarious
and just terrible.
Because they were
bad. And you don't have to watch the entire clip.
Yeah,
you it was just
go,
kind of a you just flip
seconds.
It up.
You didn't have to
and
scroll through a
is.
5 minute video.
And that's kind of, you know, the attention span of the new millennial generation. Yeah, whatever. I mean, if you're
as if you're
all
not
you
a
Gen
millennial.
Xers, sorry, but
he goes, yeah, whatever. You're a millennial too.
Yeah. So either way though, will it be missed or the world has kind of moved in the direction of Facebook Live.
In a situation
the world has kind of moved in the direction of, you know, everybody kind of has, you can post a video on Twitter, you can do it on Instagram, you can do it kind of anywhere.
Snapchat and Facebook is kind of taken over.
As well.
Yeah.
They've
kind of
taken
over.
The news service that Snapchat has developed as well, where you can get, you know, you have teams, the NFL is on Snapchat, if all the New York Jets on Snapchat, all you got to do is you got to look through and, you know, just kind of click it. You don't have to even go. It's even easier to do than Vine. So,
and they're able to get stuff. And I've seen posts from the sideline of NFL football games that are, you know, seconds after it happens.
Exactly.
So I'm watching
that's even
on the
faster.
TV.
Yeah, that's
and then
as
boom,
fast as
I see it
get.
On my phone, and then it happens on the TV. So, I mean, Snapchat and Facebook kind of control that situation now.
Yeah.
Yep.
Well, and you can't forget about just the vines that we grew up with that have nothing to do with sports, like, what are those? And like everything. And
yeah!
You can't forget about that stuff. All right, finally, in the Furious 5, we don't talk about Obama nearly, well, we don't talk about it at all, but President Obama has shared in an interview with Rolling Stone, he shared Super Bowl and NBA championship picks this week. He picked the Golden State Warriors to win the NBA, and he picked the New England Patriots to win the Super Bowl. Guys, your analysis on President Obama's picks.
I thought it was really funny.
Yeah,
I mean, good. We see this all the time.
But the reason he picked the Warriors, I'm not agreeing with. He only picked the Warriors just because of Kevin Durant signing with them. So that's kind of on the fence for me. I mean, you do have...
Oh, excuse me. Yeah, so... this article is from the Rolling Stone, but he appeared on Sway in the Morning, because that's what every president should do. Appear on Sway in the Morning. President Obama, you can come on the Average Joe Sports Show anytime
I think,
you want.
Absolutely. I think the best the best thing out of this story was the Denver Broncos tweet back to him, where it's a picture of the Broncos at the White House giving Obama a jersey, and the Broncos reply, thought we had a thing, B. And they call the President of the United States B. And like, that's, yeah, sure. Like, the Broncos were upset about this. But I do actually really like his pick of the Seahawks and the Pats again.
I think it's kind of a cop-out. I think it's kind of an uneducated pick.
Bandwagon.
No,
it could be a bandwagon.
Hey, I agree
I mean,
with it.
If he didn't pick the Bears, that would kind of be a bandwagon.
Oh, I don't know why. Jay Cutler's back. Why would you ever pick the Bears?